G'day, it's Daniel Harford. Welcome to the Best of the Breakfast Club on RSN 927. It was jam-packed. Check it out.
Great to have Adam White back with us, of course. He's the main man around here on the Breakfast Club, and he's back on a Friday morning, and I'm sure, as a cricket-loving man of many, many decades, he'd be still in shock at the news overnight. So, Whitey, good morning.
Yeah, good morning, Harf. Absolutely shocked. Numb, almost, to be honest. You know, he was my hero growing up. I just wanted to be Dean Jones. You know, he'd been in the backyard and then even playing junior cricket. I mean, we're the same age. We're both 43. So through the sort of the mid to late 80s into the early 90s, he was just everything to me. He was my absolute idol. So, yeah, I've just, you know, I found out the news last night. I thought, no, this is some sort of mistake, or, you know, like, it just didn't make sense at all. I don't know, I'm a bit lost for words. Now, that's very rare, but in this situation, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I could reel off all his big innings. I remember most of them. The 145 at the Gabba against England in the one-day game was still one of my favourite innings of all time. Obviously, what happened in India, but he made a double century against the West Indies at the Adelaide Oval. I mean, you could just keep going on and on and on. And and he was one of those generational players, a transformational player, to be able to do what he did in one-day cricket. He brought that game forward. I think that's going to be the one thing that's going to stand out more than anything else. The way he played one-day cricket, the arrogance, the confidence, the brashness, all those sorts of things. That's one of the key reasons you wanted to be him, because he loved to take the game on. And, quite extraordinary.
Yeah, no doubt about that. No doubt. An icon of cricket through that time, particularly from a Victorian perspective. He was that guy that... And when all the New South Welshmen were getting games, and there was this lone Victorian every now and then out there, it was Dean Jones, and we all sort of clung to him like a shag on a rock, or a barnacle on the bottom of a boat, because he was our man, and he was our poster boy, literally poster boy. I mean, how many posters would have been of Dean Jones in bedrooms across Victoria?
Look, absolutely. You think of the zinc cream on the bottom lip. Yep. You know, I had a county bat because he had a county bat. And then there was the move from county to Kookaburra. He was the first person to wear sunglasses in the field. You know, the running between the wickets, turning ones into twos, twos into threes into fours. The charge, just that the lofted on drive down the ground, those sorts of things. I mean, you know, they'll never leave you. And then, as you said, when he was dropped from the test team, which was such a controversy at the time, ahead of a test series in 92 against the West Indies, and Damian Martin took his spot after leading the averages in Sri Lanka. He was left out of the team, and he was 12th man at the Gabba. It just rocked particularly Victorians, because it was just seen as a complete travesty. And what had happened, the cynics as to why he got dropped from the team, it was talked about for years afterwards.
Yeah.
Because he had an average of 47 in Test cricket, or 46 in Test cricket. His last Test match in Australia was against India at the Wacker, where he made 100. And they said he went and did well in Sri Lanka, and then he's out of the Test team, never to play again. Never to wear the baggy green again.
Yeah, it was a fascinating end. Of course, we caught up with him in our Legends series not too long ago, and by goodness, I'm glad we did. Speaking of Legends, Adam Ramanauskas is one of those. He's a Bombers champion, a premiership player, and these days manager to the Stars, and he, like all of us, I'm sure, was enamoured with the charisma of Dean Jones as a batsman. Rama, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. It's a very reflective morning. I just didn't think I'd be reflecting on Dean Jones's life this early. It's... Yeah, it was heartbreaking last night hearing the news. And, you know, when my wife even yelled out that Dean Jones has passed away, you know the impact. It wasn't just on males as kids growing up, but it was, you know, females that love cricket as well. He just had such an impact. And, you know, he was our hope as kids, as a batsman, because like Whitey said, it was filled with, you know, New South Welshmen or then David Boone. Really, and then it was David Boone and Dean Jones that we all sort of loved, because they weren't from New South Wales. And, you know, just watching how he played, he was before his time, just in excitement. If he was playing in this era now, with the way T20 cricket is played around the world, he would be the biggest name in world cricket just by the way he goes about it. And you know, we talk about his batting so much, but you know, his fielding, you know, deep cover, deep mid wicket, the way he used to just roam that boundary, then whip that ball in over the stumps. You know, that's we as much as we wanted to bat like him, we wanted to field like him as well because he was just so good. And yeah, it's a tricky morning because we just all loved him. We all loved Dean Jones as kids, as Victorian kids growing up. You know, playing cricket in the schoolyard when you'd play at lunchtime. I want to be Dean Jones, and it was simple as that.
As well summed up as an SMS, not an SMS, a tweet last night going around, and I did laugh, although I was quite sad about the whole thing. When you're a kid, you're Merv Hughes. When you batted, you were Dean Jones. I mean, that was cricket in the 80s, wasn't it, for Victorian kids and 90s. That's how it worked. So that was the impact that we all know how big Merv was around the nation and around the world. But Dino was certainly carrying that legacy as well. There's a lot of SMS traffic coming through this morning off the machine and keeping coming through. Totally shocked. Sits proudly in Victorian cricket's greatest ever team. Morning, boys. Sad morning with the passing of Dean Jones. Like most kids, I grew up idolising Dino. One thing I always remembered and loved was well after he retired. This is great. There was always bring back Dino banners draped over the fences of the grandstands of the MCG. Long after he retired, the banners were still there. That's a great memory. Well done. Well done.
Interview with Dino back in June
was excellent. We'll play a bit of that through the morning, Whitey. Sorry, it's some of that interview we had as part of our Legend series.
Well, there's that time half where he kind of quit and then decided to change his mind and try and come back. And you might remember he tried to come back for that World Cup and he played for Australia A and got that shocking LBW decision when he was about 30 not out when he was playing against the West Indies. And then he didn't get selected. He got into the 30 but couldn't get into the 15. And then there was that time where he played against Australia at the MCG in the celebration game, where he scored in a really tough wicket. He scored 100 against Australia. And then there was the other game that he had his own tribute game, where Plucker Duck was playing and all sorts of things. And then they all turned up to watch him playing that as well. So, yeah, I mean, I got nervous when he went out to bat. You know, I was like a cat in a hot tin roof, you know, like you just, because you knew that if he did well, your day was sorted. Like, you know, it was just, it was so much hinging on him doing well. And it was also what he represented with, I talked before about the confidence and the brashness, you know, going out to bat at number three for Australia, prepared to take people on. Often he wouldn't wear a helmet, you know, the sweatband on the hand, on the wrist, you know, like, you know, we talked many times about the Kirtley Ambrose incident. He feared nobody. And as he spoke to us half when we did that interview with him, he talked about how at times how nervous he was about fearing his safety, how quick the bowling was and all those sorts of things, but you would never have known it. And so, see, I think he was very representative of a young teenager, you know, a young boy growing up, just wanting to have his confidence. 59.
He was simply, the way he played cricket was before his time. Like from an excitement point of view, it was, you know, Dean Jones and Viv Richards because of just the swagger they had. And, you know, obviously Viv had an amazing career. But we didn't see, obviously, a lot of Viv Richards because he was a West Indian. But, yeah, Dean Jones was just that 87 World Cup, third most runs to, you know, to David Boone and to Jeff Marsh, which nobody talks about. 89 Ashes series, we think of Mark Taylor and Steve Waugh as their real coming out sort of party and them as cricketers. But Dean Jones, second most runs in that series to Mark Taylor. I think it was over 500 runs in that series. Like, it's just... And it's just little things that you reflect on now and you go, he was just an amazing cricketer.
Let's get some feedback from our listeners. You're welcome to give us a call, 1300 652 927, through the morning, but certainly in this little window as well, or 0416 90 50 52, and the SMSs do keep flooding in. Bobby's in Seaford with his assessment and reflections on Dino. Good morning, Bobby.
Morning, guys. How are we going? It's a sad morning for cricket for Australia and especially Victoria.
It is. Absolutely it is.
He's his batting itself, when he played the West Indies, he copped that much short stuff, and he just pulled into the boundary after boundary after boundary. He wasn't afraid of nothing whatsoever. And then he's feeling, like you're saying, from the boundary line, he had one of the best arms I've ever seen. And then, like, he's running between wickets. I think he changed cricket altogether in one-day cricket and test cricket. And he also got the crowds of the MCG. I think the crowds of the MCG went up 50% once he got a game.
So, I reckon you're right.
That's a true fact as well. I think when he made that 200 in India, I think he lost about 5 or 6 kilos through the innings. I think, if I'm correct, I'm not too sure. But, yeah, he was a legend, and he always will be.
Yeah, he was most unwell after that. He talked about that a little well. It was almost mocked, wasn't it, in the end, because he spoke about it so often, and the story just grew and grew and grew, and because that was his sporting night story for years, the 210 at Madras in the tied test.
That's still the highest score by an Australian in India, still.
Is that right?
Yep.
Righto. Yeah, well, and such an important time too, to because we were in all sorts of trouble. And I saw Mike Atherton talking overnight, reflecting on that story and talking about how Alan Border pushed him out the door when probably he had no right to do so. Get back out there. And Dino spoke to us about that as well before, throughout the year when we spoke to him.
One of the great highlights I always remember growing up was when there was the Perth Challenge, the one-day series that was held in Perth, involving England, Pakistan, the West Indies and Australia. And you might remember they wore it was a slightly different one-day international shirt. It had a bit of white in the middle and yellow and green. And he made consecutive hundreds. I think it was consecutive nights. There may have been a day in between. But that was when he was at his absolute prime. And they lost both of those matches, amazingly. But that was when, you know, Pakistan had Imran Khan and Wasim Akram, and the West Indies had who they had on fast, bouncy pitches at the Wacker. And he made 100 in both of those matches. I don't know. It's just, I can't believe we're having these conversations. As in that he's no longer with us. Because he was a polarising figure. He's a polarising figure because he just wanted... He wanted to make sure Victoria was as good as it could be at cricket. He wanted to make sure that cricket was as good as it could be. And he challenged people to get the best out of themselves and for cricket to get the best out of itself. And he spoke his mind.
Yep. He
say what often a lot of people thought but wasn't prepared to say.
Yeah, no, he was absolutely happy to talk about things that most people weren't prepared to talk about or analyse it the way that others weren't prepared to analyse it. I must admit, as an admirer and a lover of Dino as a kid watching, getting to know him as an adult and working with him a few times, he would talk to you about cricket as if you'd played 100 tests with him. Yeah. He didn't matter. He knew clearly I didn't play cricket, but loved it. But he would respect you enough to talk to you as if you had played that level of cricket and that intimate knowledge of the game, and he'd challenge you on your thoughts on it. And I love talking cricket with Dino because he'd respect you enough to talk to you openly and respectfully, clearly, but would challenge you on why you saw things that way and how it unfolded in your mind. And then he'd come in with his take on it. It was a great, robust discussion about how and why. In the world of cricket. He did join us, as we mentioned, on the RSN Legends Series, and by goodness, we're glad he did, on the 17th of June. So what are we? In September, so 3 months ago. Effectively, around about 3 months ago, we had Dino on the line for our Legends Series, and he was talking about his omission from the test team and reflecting on the end of his career overall. Let's have a listen to Dino on the Legends Series.
The communication was poor back then, and... I sort of the communication was just shocking from Simo and AB to me. Oh, I didn't know until 10 o'clock, 9:30, when the team was announced, and then the crowd roared. So they were happy with me being dropped. I said, "Hang on, I've just come off Sri Lanka scoring the most runs in one day in Test matches, and I never got a sniff back. My career was finished at 30 in Test cricket. So sadly, or 31, and then Michael Hussey started his career at that age.
That's right.
And my best years as a cricketer, as a batsman, was probably 31 to 37. I was making probably close to 1,000 every year for Victoria from then on. But the bottom line is, though, boys, after being smashed by the West Indies in 84, If you said to me, Dino, you're going to play in three Ashes winning series, you're going to win a World Cup, you're going to reach number one ODI batsman in the world for 4 years, you know, you're going to make so many runs for Victoria, I'd be thinking you're on drugs. Because when I hopped on the plane back from the West Indies, I was thinking of finding a new job. And the game just turned around. And now I'm coach and I work as a commentator overseas and I'm still involved with the game, still love the game. And I just love it. It's been tough at times. It's been a hell of a ride, though. And thanks to this great game, which I didn't really love as much compared to footy, it's given me a great thing in life. It's been fantastic.
There he is from June 17, Dino, with our Legend Series chat, which no doubt I'll be playing again very, very shortly or some stage today. You talked to then about his involvement of latter day times, and that shouldn't be forgotten either. His T20 coaching was really successful, particularly on the subcontinent, in the IPL and the Pakistan Premier League or Super League, whatever it's called. He was a championship winning coach, and his strategy and his ability to see the game, even in T20, a game he never played, but adapt his mind to be able to think about how to gain advantage or stop momentum was quite a fascinating, a great insight into the mind of Dean Jones. And there was a Greg Baum article, boys, floating around last night on Twitter as well, talking about who the next captain of Australian cricket should be. And it was a piece from obviously many, many moons ago. And it outlined the criteria, who it shouldn't be, and it went through a list of criteria and then who it should be and a list of criteria. At the end, it was only a small story. And at the end, it was just two words, Dean Jones, because of the way that he presented his love of the game, his ability to confront difficult issues, inspire teams, but also tactically such a sound leader at that time, and clearly since that time as well. It was a nice little piece floating around, which I'm sure you could track down on the socials. He did send me, I just want to highlight this, he did send me a message a month after we had him on in June. He said, just sending some love to your show, mate. It's funny, educational, opinionated, everything with a nice balance. Good job. And I bring this up because of what you said before about that Bicentennial Classic, Whitey. I said, thank you, mate. Much appreciated. Because it was on the TV. It was on Foxtel, those games throughout the last couple of months.
Yep. Yeah.
I said, I was only watching you make 100 v Pakistan in Perth in 87 this morning and loved it. And he came back immediately because he was watching it too, clearly. And he said, I made 200s in less than 24 hours and we lost both games. And exploded.
There you go.
It's 30 years ago and I'm still pissed off with it. I need to get a life. Like that's the competitor. That was my last communication with Dino a couple of months ago. But he was that guy. He was fully supportive of everyone. He was one of my biggest fans, I must admit. I don't know why, but he was very supportive of me through my time in footy and in the media. So it was shocking news last night. I can't believe it. He's not here with us.
No. Like, I mean, even he talked himself just from that interview about his passion for Victoria and how good he was after his Australian days. I mean, he made 324 in a Sheffield Shield game at the MCG under lights. He made a truckload of runs for Victoria. He was one of the key people that brought Brad Hodge through as a young player for Victoria. And Hodgie became the new Dean Jones in a lot of ways. I remember when I was living in England, driving down to Canterbury to watch him play for Derbyshire at the very end of his career. Dean Jones, back in 97, Dean Jones spent a couple of years at Derbyshire right towards the end. So he played a lot of county cricket and helped bring a lot of the next guys through. But he was one of those guys, you know, he wanted to stay in the team. You know, he wanted to get people to knock him out. He wanted people to learn, not the hard way necessarily, but it was, you know, you had to earn your spot. So,
He made you check the Shield scores when he was omitted from the Australian team. It was just, I need to check the scores to see. You'd rush home from school and try to get, you know, the update of how Victoria and how Dean Jones went in the Shield game. We're lost for words, really. We just can't believe it. You don't think a person of that sort of nature is going to be gone so soon. Like you said, Arb, he's sending text messages to you. I was late to the party joining Twitter. He was the first person that sent me a message to say, welcome aboard.
Was he really?
Yep. Just absolutely love. Whitey and I were having a bit of fun with him not long ago, weren't we, Whitey? When you put a team together and you didn't have Dean Jones in it, and I sort of tagged him into something, and he responded straight back. And that's just the guy that he was, and he's just got to be missed dearly through the cricket world.
No doubt about that. Michael Clark has just spoken on the Big Sports Breakfast up in Sydney, our sister show up there on their sports radio show. We're going to get to that very shortly. Just go through his numbers, just an overall reflection of his cricketing impact in his time out there in the centre wicket. 52 matches or tests for Australia, 89 innings, 11 not outs, 3,631 runs with a high score of 216 at an average of 46.55. 11 centuries and 14 fifties. In one day internationals, 164 matches, 25 not outs, 6,068 runs with 145 that day at the Gabba, Whitey, which I'll never forget. And that shot that he played down the ground, and Richie Beno says, just reach out and catch it, Jeffrey, from the commentary box. In fact, I'm going to get Joey to get that. It was floating around last night too. At an average of 44.61, if you don't mind, 7 centuries and 46 half centuries. First class runs, 245 matches, 415 innings, 45 not outs, 19,188 runs, a top score of 324, as Whitey mentioned, for Victoria, which I made in the garage that very same day against my brother, and it broke him. at an average of 51.85, and I retired on 324 because Dino made 324. 55 centuries and 88 50s. And more importantly, well, not more importantly, but just as importantly, in his test career, he bowled 198 balls, conceded 64 runs, and got one wicket. And that, of course, was the wicket of the great Sir Richard Hadley, who he used to mock ferociously because he was the one. He was that one wicket that Dino got in Test cricket. So that's his impact on the world of cricket.
The irony about that was that Richard Hadley was one that had his measure. Yeah. There was a one particular series back in the late 80s where he just couldn't play him. And a lot of people struggled to play him, mind you. But, that was a great battle between Hadley and Jones.
Let's have a listen to Michael Clark. Rama, sorry, mate. Just a couple of minutes of Michael Clark just reflecting on Dean Jones and his relationship with him, the former Australian captain, talking about Dean Jones.
If you knew Dino, you knew what happened in Madras because he told you that story about 50 times. And that's what I loved about Dino. He knew how good a player he was. He was so proud of his achievements and representing. I think you wouldn't find too many prouder cricketers that loved representing their state. He was such a proud Victorian, but also their country as much as Dean Jones. And look, I think we will all remember Dino for the way he played the game, the success he had, the entertainment he brought to the game. But for mine, I think the one thing about Dean Jones that was always underrated was his coaching. I've said for a long time, I was surprised he never got the chance to be involved with the Australian cricket team as a coach. Even when I was captain of Australia, I would ask Dino to come into the change room and talk to the boys. One of the things that probably brought our friendship closer together was the way we loved facing spin bowling. And we would always talk about moving our feet and trying to dominate spinners. And I know he did a lot of work with South Australian cricket when Hughesy was playing for South Australia. And, you know, again, that was one of the things that we had in common, that he loved Philip Hughes. And he would always want these young up-and-coming batsmen to go out there and play their natural game. Don't fear getting out, or don't be scared to play your shots. And like I say, I think the success he had as a coach in the 2020 leagues around the world will probably not be spoken about as much as they should, because he knew the game so well, and he had this thing about him that he could bring the best out in you. He could build you up to make you feel so confident in your own ability that brought success to you. Before you even walked out to bat, you were going to make runs because of what he instilled in you. And I have no doubt, again, Dino was before my time as a player. I never got to play with him, but I have no doubt that's what made him such a great player against so many good attacks. He just had that confidence that, you know, he wasn't scared. He was fearless, and he was going to take you on. So, yeah, so many great memories. And
Michael Clark on the Big Sports Breakfast up there in Sydney, reflecting on the impact of Dean Jones.
That final comment, Whitey, just he was a fearless batsman. He was nervous, as he said to you guys, but he was fearless, walking down the pitch against some of those bowling tacks and just whacking them through covers or mid wicket. And then you can still see it, and I can picture it in my own mind still.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I'm going to put a lot of pressure on our digital team here, but for all the text messages that are coming through, because we've got pages of them coming through, what we might do is we might set up a page on rsn.net.au just with everyone's messages. So if you want to pay tribute to Dean Jones, send the text through or send a tweet through or a Facebook post, and we'll put them all together on a page on our website, just so people can pay their respects to one of Victoria's, obviously Australia's as well, one of Victoria's greatest ever sports people, because he was.
I wonder if Lucas Herbert was a man from Snowy River lover. He's one of our great friends on the golfing circuit across the planet, and he's just fresh off the US Open. He's in the Irish Open at the moment. He's joined us. Lucas, a good morning.
Hello, boys. How are we doing?
Mate, we're going very well. How are you doing? We haven't spoken for a long time.
Yeah, I'm not doing too bad. Navigating the challenges of playing golf and travelling in a COVID-stricken world, but not doing too bad.
Yeah, so you've been in the States for a fair while, haven't you, having to get through all this and survive the... well, basically get out of Australia so you could play in the golfing circuit. Is that right?
Yeah, kind of. Obviously not really much going on back in Australia golf-wise. So I had starts in the FedEx and Jude... WGC event down in Memphis, and then the following week in the USPGA, and then I had 5 weeks off, and then the US Open last week in New York. So I decided, yeah, to get over to America and kind of base myself over there for most of the summer rather than trying to travel between the UK and America back and forth. So yeah, that was kind of what I went up to.
How difficult has it, Lucas, trying to play in some of the biggest tournaments in the world where you're not playing a lot of golf? Has it been a challenge for you?
Yeah, on one hand, it's a little bit difficult, obviously, with, you know, you probably feel a little bit rusty heading into the events. You sort of, you know, maybe haven't got that match practice, that match fitness where you'd like it. But then also, I think it can have an added benefit in the guys that were playing, you know, pretty regularly out there, they had a pretty hectic schedule from when the restart happened in June. So by the time we got to the US Open, they were actually, you know, pretty beat up with three playoff events and I think a WGC and a major in there as well. Like, they were sort of, yeah, probably getting to the end of their tether, and Wingfoot obviously needs some patience and needs all your attention and focus to kind of play well out there. So it probably had some benefits, as well as obviously not probably having the match fitness I would have liked.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell us what it was like playing in the US Open, one of the most famous golf courses in the world, in New York at Wingfoot. You were our leading Australian. You finished inside the top 35. What was the experience like?
Oh, phenomenal. It was just awesome. Obviously with Jeff Ogilvy winning there in 06, just to be able to go there and see all the shots that sort of watched on TV back then, and just get a real appreciation for the golf course. And I mean, even for the up and down that Jeff made on 18 to win, I mean, once you go there and you see how much slope is at the front of that green, you kind of understand how good that shot was, because you know, that slope looks about hip high on TV when you watch his shot back, but it's a lot higher than that, I can tell you that much. So, yeah, phenomenal experience. Just brutally tough. I know everyone says that. And it's sort of hard to appreciate just watching it on TV. But, yeah, every single shot tests you, you know, to the max of your ability all day. And sort of the nature of the beast is you're probably going to hit a lot of good shots that actually get punished pretty badly. So you kind of just got to have that mindset going in. Obviously, I finished at 12 over and had a great week. So It's quite a bit different to normal, where, you know, 12 over is not going to win you a hell of a lot of money. So, you know, just getting your head around that and coming in with the right mindset to be able to tackle that is key.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you about, Lucas. Obviously, so many guys were over par. We're so used to seeing you guys so far under par on so many of these courses, but obviously the way that course was set up was to play over par. How do you keep your mind in that zone that, yeah, okay, you're playing good golf, even though you finished at 12 over, that you are playing good golf and you are hitting the ball well in a tournament like that?
Yeah, I mean, just trying to be honest with the self-assessment on the way around. If you can make a bogey hitting on a par four, hitting five, pretty good shots. You know, you can just, you know, you might just miss your tee shot one way or the other a couple of yards, and all of a sudden you're in some rough in a bad lie, and you know, now you're hitting out to a spot that even then is behind the eight ball as well, and it's just very challenging. You know, the whole day you feel like it's testing you with every shot. If you do make a bogey, it can take seven or eight holes to try and get that back if you play well. It's sort of not really a golf course where you can go out and make four birdies on the trot. You know, if you make a double, it's going to take nine holes to get it back if you play really well. So definitely, I mean, the mindset I took in was I didn't want to make anything worse than a bogey. So as soon as I got out of position, it was trying to give myself the best chance to be able to make nothing worse than a bogey. And I think I only made two doubles for the week, which I was pretty proud of. And just, you know, pars are almost celebrated like birdies, and birdies are even better. So, yeah, it's sort of just it's a funny one to wrap your head around. But, again, not really playing a lot, I felt like that was maybe a bit of an advantage as well, whereas, you know, all those guys are sort of used to seeing 15 or 20 under up on the leaderboard. You know, I just hadn't really been used to seeing anything.
Looking at Caulfield tomorrow for Underwood Stakes Day, it's a ripping day of racing. The weather may play a part, Dino. I'm sure you've calculated that into your selections, but we have a look at the quaddy legs, try and sharpen the pencil, give you a chance to narrow the fields a little bit before you really drill down on Saturday morning with the panel, Dino and the boys on RSN 927, getting ready for your Saturday quaddy. But let's have a look at the first leg of the quaddy. It is the Caulfield Guineas Prelude over the 1400 metres, three-year-old Group 3 event, Dino, and there are 13 going around, and there's some really talented horses obviously going around building up towards the Guineas, the Group 1 Guineas, but Flying Award, who was second last time out for D. Oliver and D. O'Brien behind Immortal Love, rattled home, Dino, over the 1200. You imagine the 1400 with suit is $5 favourite at tab.com.au.
Yeah, he's a very good horse and a real good, really good Guineas chance, and maybe even a three-year-old Cox Plate chance if he keeps progressing. Wow. Whether 1400 second up's absolutely ideal, but he'll be absolutely smashing through the line and he can win. I think it'll be a really good race for the Hayes Dabinigard. I think Crosshaven is just a very good 1,400-metre horse, as he showed at Flemington, and he'll ride the speed. And the other one is Azar, number 8. I think he's a good talent as well. He probably needed that run first up, but he'll be a lot fitter. He drops a lot in weight, and I think he can run very well. I'll be certainly putting Flying Award in the quaddie. I'll be putting Amish Boy in the quaddie too, number 5. He had reasonable form last time in, but Kieran Maher gave him a huge push on the radio the Saturday before his first up run, and he ran well at the big odds, and the 1400 is going to suit him. So I think they're the four main chances, but expecting Cherry Tortoni to run tonight, and you know, Prague's a good chance, but he's just drawn a very awkward gate. But it's an absolute cracking race, and probably shapes the Guineas from a Victorian point of view anyway.
Yeah, it's a good point about what's happening tonight. So there are a lot of dual acceptors at the moment with options to run tonight or tomorrow at Caulfield. I think one of those was, I'll remember it, so I've had a blank. One of those was one of the big names racing today or tonight, or tonight or tomorrow. So I'll check that in a little bit later on. But Quinny, what is the market? I mean, $5 for the favourite says it's a pretty open Guineas Prelude.
Yeah, the money has come for Flying Award, though. $7 into 5, the new favourite at that quote. We've got Prague, $6.50, Crosshaven, $8, Acer, $9.50, and the bolt of the Dino gave a good push for Amish Boy, a $19 chance. Dino, you've left out Camborne, who was initially favourite when the market was posted, now a $5.50 second favourite, is undefeated, but you're just put off by the step-up in class.
Look, he's a very nice horse, and whether, again, 1,400 around Caulfield, he looks a really big action horse, got to Bendigo and looked tremendous. Just where he's drawn, I can't envision him getting the best of runs. He'd need to have probably a bit on this field, and I think he's as good as many of them, but he'll just need a bit of luck to get the right run.
Now, Cherry Tortoni, you mentioned, is still in tonight, so you would presume would go around at Moonee Valley tonight. If Cherry Tortoni was to go around in this race, would you give him a chance over the 1,400 metres, or do you sort of like him down the track and like the fact they're sticking with the mile tonight?
Yeah, I think tonight would be his go, and maybe even Elcio, and they're both in tonight, and they're both looking as though they're Derby chances, so they're probably wanting to get to 1,600 metres, so I'd imagine they'll run tonight.
All right, that's the first look at the first leg of the quaddie. Alpha Oro is the one I was talking about too. Race 4 yes. Tomorrow. Caulfield's also in tonight for Matt Laurie. So we'll see what happens there, Dino. So the numbers are taken by Adam Ramanauskas. He's got one job throughout this segment, just to take the numbers and give them to us as he receives them. Rama, what are the numbers for race 6, please, tomorrow at Caulfield, the first leg of the quaddie?
3, 8, 4, and 5.
3, 8, 4, and 5. Now, race 7 is the 1,000 guineas. Prelude again, 1,400 metres. Group 2 for the 3-year-old fillies. And a field of 12 going around, Dino. And there is, well, there's a good price favourite. A filly who is yet to be defeated in her 3 starts. A not a single doubt filly for Philip Stokes. Instant celebrity with Craig Williams on board tomorrow, who's in hot form. She is favourite at tab.com.au. Is she your number one selection?
She is, Daniel. She's very well named because she's just jumped out of the ground and become a bit of a star very quickly. She won her first start in Adelaide and then won a stakes race over there, and then her first up win was just exceptional. She'll just need a bit of luck because she lacks a touch of tactical speed, but gee, she's got a booming finish on her, and I'm going with her. But this is the leg of the quaddie I really want to load up. I'm giving chances to 6 Personal, who I think did more than enough first up and is back to filly's grade. More importantly, she's basically raced against the boys all of her career. 1 Let's Be Glam is a good filly. I thought she ran well enough first up. She's a Blue Diamond Prelude winner at this track. 11 Ana Visto. I thought she got it a little bit wrong in the Dane Hill Stakes, but that often happens to horses down the straight early in their career. She could bounce back here. And chances to 5 Night Raid, who was good at Moonee Valley, and 8 Mozzie Monster, another terrific race. I thought last week's fillies race looked pretty strong, but this one's got a lot more depth again. So it's a really solid race, but I am with Instant Celebrity.
So Instant Celebrity, Quinny, who is coming across from Adelaide, of course, after those 3 wins, and as Dino said, is a blistering turn of foot late, but he's also given us a few numbers there. So is that a reflection of the market as well? Is a few being nibbled at?
Yeah, a little bit. Daniel, Instant Celebrity has been a firmer 340 into 310. We've got Night Raider, $4 second elect, Mozzie Monster, $6.50 with Personal, and then double figures or better the rest. Number 7, Rock My Wanders, firm from 21 into 16. Dino, do you anticipate this will be the form line that gives us the winner of the 1,000 guineas, or have you got a few number 1, 2, or 3 seeds elsewhere?
No, I think this is a really good chance to probably add Agreeable, who I thought ran quite well last week, and a couple of others from last week. The thing with the Sydney fillies, they probably look a little bit better, but horses like Hungry Heart and Dame Giselle, but the flight stakes at Group 1's only a week before the 1,000 guineas, so whether they'd come down on the quick backup would be hard to imagine. So I think it'll probably be the Victorian and the South Australian fillies fighting it out.
All right. So that's an interesting race, the second leg of the quaddie tomorrow at Caulfield. Rama, what are those numbers, please?
4, 6, 1, 11, 5, and 8.
4, 6, 1, 11, 5, and 8. Second leg of the quaddie. All right, let's have a look at the third leg of the quaddie. It's a premiership quarter in the quaddie, no doubt about that, the third leg. And it's the feature event on the car, the Highland Race Colours Underwood Stakes, 1,800 metres, wait for age, Group 1 activity worth $750,000. And most of these ones, in fact, all of them, we have well-exposed form, Dino, which gives us a chance to drill down. And down the bottom of this 10-horse field is an emerging galloper who has the entire racing fraternity talking. Of course, we speak of Russian Camelot with a weight pull on some older, more experienced horses here, Dino. He's in red figures at the moment, $1.95 at the tab. Is there a reason for that?
There is. He's a massive talent. He gets to Caulfield here. 1,800 is going to suit. So far, we've basically seen him on the really big galloping tracks like Ballarat, Flemington. Then obviously went to Adelaide and he ran at Pakenham and back to Flemington. So he's been on all the bigger tracks. This is a little bit of an interesting challenge for him. I think the horse with comparable ability is Arcadia Queen, and at least I think her second up run showed she's working her way back to form. I don't think there's a lot between them, and yet there is a bit of a difference in the price. So for that reason, off barrier one, I'm just going to go with Arcadia Queen from Russian Camelot, but no shock if either of the two win. Just want to put in a couple in, though. I think the Chosen One's come back really well this time in. That was a big win first up. And six, Mr. Quickie, who ran really well behind Behemoth in the Memsie. Know that form stacks up well. He's just developed a bit of a bad habit of being slow out, and he's probably going to be behind Russian Camelot, and then the challenge is to get past him. So he's probably next best. But, it's a really it's a good race. Not big on numbers, but I think the two down the bottom hold the key.
All right, a bit of assessment there from Dino. Quinny, what about your assessment, the market's assessment of this race? So Russian Camelot all the rage, it seems.
Yeah, punters are with Russian Camelot. 2.10 into $1.95. Arcadia Queen now a $4.60 chance. So Arcadia Queen is normally the same price. I'll try that again in English. Arcadia Queen is almost the same price, the place, that Russian Camelot is the win there at $1.60. Mr. Quickie, a $7.50 chance. The Chosen One, $11. Just on Russian Camelot, Dino, obviously very, very exciting, but you're not tipping him tomorrow. You're certainly not knocking him, but do you think maybe the boom doesn't quite meet the level of performance to date?
Oh, he can. No, he could win and win easily tomorrow. There's no doubt about that. I think Arcadia Queen is getting back to the best of her form, and the best is certainly good enough to win this race. That's all I'm going on. But Russian Camelot is very much a work in progress. We'll be very interested to see where he ends up at the end of the spring. If he won a Cox Plate as a valuable stallion, would he go on to a Melbourne Cup? He's been the Melbourne Cup favourite for a long time. I'm really interested to see his progress in the next 3 weeks to a month. I think Cox Plate Day will be such a significant day, and if those that have taken him in the Melbourne Cup would probably want him to get beaten in the Cox Plate, to be honest.
That's a good point. Ramo, can you give us the numbers, please, for the third leg, the Premiership Quarter of the Quaddie tomorrow?
9, 10, 7, and 6.
Dino, we have one to go. It is the Evergreen Turf Handicap over the 1,700 metres. There is a full field going around tomorrow, which is great news. Nonconformist for Graham Bing is the favourite at tab.com.au. It was third on resumption after a 160-day spell behind I Am Superman. Second up record, one start. And a placing. Are you as confident about Nonconformist as the market is at tab.com.au?
I think it's a pretty thin race for winning chances, Daniel. There's a lot of horses here that are probably getting ready for something a bit further down the track or even on the comeback trail. And he's certainly one of the three chances. There's a bit of a thought that he's a lightweight Caulfield Cup chance. So if that's the case, he'll need to run well here. I think Inverloch will run really well. I thought he trialled up well before his first up run. Even though he trialled well, I didn't know if he could really fire at 1,400 metres, but he did. He ran a terrific race, and any rain for him over the next 24 hours is an absolute bonus. He's an Easter Cup winner at Caulfield, so I think he'll run really well. But good chances to Nonconformist, who was really solid first up, and he's going to get better as the races get longer. And 9, Junipel, who he won well at Moonee Valley, he's just got to get beyond 1,600 and be really strong. But he hit the line pretty nicely last start, and he's trending the right way, and any given the ground's a bonus for him. So I think any of those three will be comfortable if it comes up a bit softer. They're the three main chances, and the trim-up leg for the quaddie.
A trim-up leg for the quaddie in the last one. I like that. I like that a lot, Quinny. Are you going to be trimming? Not your
I
hair.
I think so. Nonconformist has been popular, 480 into 360. Junipel, a 380 second elect, and there's been money for Inverloch, $13 into 10. Dino, the third elect shot of Irish was heavily backed the day you successfully declared Junipel a moral. That day, though, shot of Irish took no part in the race, and there was that unfortunate incident with Dwayne Dunn. How do you assess shot of Irish, and is that something that does jolt your confidence with a horse a little bit?
Well, it has, because the following week at Flemington, he played up in the gates again. And he was scratching when Jamie Mott was aboard. So he's been back to the trials. He's done all that fine, but he's just got to get out of the gates. Because if he gets out of the gates, he'll lead. And if it's a soft track, he'd be in the game for sure. But it's just a worry when it looked a little bit habit-forming to do it two Saturdays in a row.
If we do back Inverloch, and no doubt heaps of punters will after that push double-figure odds, Are you half hoping that Shot of Irish does play up in the gates or potentially is scratched, because could Inverloch get a relatively easy lead then?
No, I think it wouldn't hurt him if Shot of Irish was there. He'd just be that sort of, he'd roll along at his own speed, Shot of Irish, and then you'd have the likes of Odie and Lord Durandy and Inverloch coming across. So I'm just thinking maybe by the last race, the inside's starting to give out a little bit. He might be just in the right spot at a nice price, Inverloch.
All right, that's the last leg of the quaddy. And a trim down leg. Remo, what are those numbers, please?
4, 8, and 9.
And before my phone rings, can you and text, I'll get messages galore. Can you just give us the numbers overall for those that have just jumped on the wireless on a Friday morning? What are the quaddy numbers at this stage? I'll check your local guides, all that sort of stuff. But at this stage on a Friday morning for tomorrow's quaddy at Caulfield.
Yep. Okay. Race 6, 3, 8, 4, and 5. Race 7, 4, 6, 1, 11, 5, and 8. Race 8, 9, 10, 7, and 6. And then finally race 9, 4, 8, and 9.
All right, they're the numbers for the quaddy tomorrow at Caulfield. Do we just want to, before we do the Ramaruffi and the formula bit, do we just want to have a quick look at tonight's Group 1 feature at Moonee Valley, the Moya Stakes? Have a bit of a squeeze and see if we can find the winner there for the punters. Any love for anything there?
Look, it's a terrific field in that it's a 1,000-metre race and there's a lot of good 1,000-metre horses, which you want to see, so it's going to be a high-pressure race. I think it comes down to probably a little bit of luck in running. If there's too much pressure up front, like a horse like Trekking's really well suited, but he's drawn inside. He'll need luck at the right time. He didn't get it in this race last year. I think Hanseatic could be a lot fitter for that first up run. And even though she's the lowest rated horse in the race, a horse like Brooklyn Hustle, I just think the way this race sets up, she can run really well. So I'd probably have a slight leaning to her just at the price. Mark Zara aboard and just drawn away from the rail and being able to get that little fly at them late. I thought she had a good chance.
What's the market for that, Quinny, please?
It's pretty open. Fabergino's been a well-backed favourite, now a $4 chance. Bella Vista, $6. Trekking, $7.50. Pippi, $8. Diamond Effort, a $10 chance. Jungle Edge, $11. And Brooklyn Hustle, she's at $14. So one race where if you find the winner, the value will take care of itself.
Well, that's the Moya Stakes tonight at the Valley. By the way, I saw the Stat Stakes. The time on the Stat Stakes is sponsored by the EJ Witten Foundation. The EJ Witten Time to Test Stat Stakes. And any reminder is a good reminder, I reckon, for blokes out there to go and get yourselves checked. The EJ Witten Foundation do magnificent work in that field, of course. A good sponsorship tonight at the Valley. They love a bit of racing action, does the foundation. But Time to Test, a good reminder for all of us, I think, in that window, Dino, to look after ourselves as men.
That's absolutely right, Daniel. And I know that Whitey's, one of his favourite races on the calendar is the Stud Stakes, because he just made money out of it year after year.
Exactly right.
Is that correct?
Exactly right. Just whatever happens, just then look forward to the Caulfield Guineas, Dino. And other races too, mind you. Some amazing winners that have come out of that race that have either won, finished second, or third.
And a flying award scratch from that tonight too. Elsie Owens in, Dino, just for
Elsie
for
Owens
reference.
Thierry Tortoni's in, and
Thierry Tortoni,
Glenfiddich should be winning.
Glenfiddich should be winning. There you go. Nice little teaser. A bit of bonus on a Friday morning. Let's have a look at the formula bet, Dino. It's in raging hot form, is the formula bet. We love it every single week. If you want to be a part of it, register at the website rsn.net.au. Who are we playing for today, and whatever you think? What do you think?
Tracy McLaughlin of Diamond Creek is our contestant of the day. And for Tracy, we are having $40 to win race 1, number 2, How Romantic, $40 to win race 5, number 7, Windstorm, and $40 on the all-up of the pair, race 1, number 2, into race 5, number 7. So two extra races, Daniel. I know you'll love that. For Tracy McLaughlin of Diamond Creek.
All right, that's 6 done already. 6 races already tomorrow we've got covered at Caulfield. Quinny, what does that formula bet come up to, please, for Trace?
How Womantic currently at $2.90. Windstorm $2.25. The all-up comes to $6.52 pre-multiplier.
Pre-multiplier times 1.02, and you'll pay off the house in no time. Good stuff. Good luck to you, Trace. Race 1, number 2, into race 5, number 7. Which means, Dino, all we need from you now is the Ramaruffi, the time-honoured Ramaruffi.
Yeah, and we'll wait till the last, Daniel. We've already spoken of him. Race 9, number 4, Inverloch. I think he's terrific each-way odds in a race where there's not many chances. He's certainly the longest of the three that I like, but he's, I think, the best chance.
All right, race 9, number 4, Inverloch. Quinn, in the market again for Inverloch?
Currently a $10 chance, so no doubt that will be popular. Might be a good one by two bet there for each way players as well. And a big well done to both Dino and Whitey for last week, because they put a smile on the face of the contestant Jody, who had been going through some very tough times, but that was nice to see them both find a winner for her.
Yes, absolutely. And your five times there and your involvement there from the tab was much appreciated too, Quinny. So thank you for all involved there. But make sure if you want to be a part of it, register for the website rsn.net.au for Dino's Formula Bet. All right, Dino, we can let you go back and just chill out on a Friday morning now, and appreciate your time as always, and look forward to hearing more from you tomorrow on a big day of racing for RSN 927 listeners. Thank you, pal.
Terrific. Thank you, Daniel.
Good stuff. Dean Lester, the world's greatest form analyst, with us on a Friday morning on The Breakfast Club. Quinny, what do you like out there tomorrow?
Well, I'm taking on Dino, so I'm very, very flat. Oh. I'm taking $3.80 on a double Russian Camelot in the feature at Caulfield tomorrow. All up Masked Crusader in the last at Rosehill, so hopefully that is successful. And tonight, I like one at $5.50 each way in the lucky last at Moonee Valley. Number one, Mystic Journey, back to the 1,600 metres. Four starts for three wins over the trip, including the Australian Guineas in the inaugural All-Star Mile. I think she's a tremendous quote, and taking on William Pike. So feel a bit dirty taking on Dino and William Pike, and no doubt that will end terribly.
Last night was awards night in the world of Australian rules football. The Coaches Award, the AFLPA MVP, the Rising Star, and the All-Australian team was announced. And on the wing for the second year in a row is Jackson McRae, the champ from the Bulldogs, who joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Jackson.
Good morning, boys. Thanks for having me.
Good on you, buddy. Well done. Congratulations on another fantastic year, and thankfully it's not over yet from the Bulldogs' perspective, but recognition last night. How big a kick do you get out of being named as an All-Australian?
Yeah, I think it's obviously you don't play for the individual accords, but when they do come, it's really important that you do enjoy them and share it with two of my teammates and good mates, and that's a great thrill as well. So it's important that we recognise it, and it helps to have a week off so we can kind of enjoy it together and then focus for the game next weekend.
Yeah, and just on your personal view of your year compared to last season, where would you rank it?
I've probably played some of my most consistent footy at times this year, and different parts of my game has probably really grown in the leadership side, and just being a consistent performer week in, week out. So it's hard to compare years gone past, but I think, this year's been, very consistent.
Jackson, we talked to you in the middle part of the year, just talking about the differences of the shorter quarters, because you're the one that, a bit like Andrew Gaff, you'll just run all day, and the longer the game goes, the better you seem to get. Now looking back over the home and away season, do you feel you've had to make any changes to your game, or you've just done it, just not for as long?
It's probably, I remember speaking to you guys midway through the year, as I said, it's just the importance of you can't really have a down moment or a quarter, because it's hard to get it packed because the game goes so fast. So, I think it's probably taken a bit of time for a lot of people to adapt to, but at the end of the day, it's still a footy game, and I think you've seen from who's played well and who's shown that they can play the game, it hasn't really changed too much depending on how long the game goes for.
And Jackson, it can be difficult at the Bulldogs because there are so many players that not only want to play in the midfield, but can play in the midfield really well. And we've obviously seen the emergence of Bailey Smith this year. There's your usual suspects of yourself and Marcus and Lockie. Josh Dunkley at times can't even get in the midfield this year. It's I can imagine at times it can be difficult to sometimes get in that rhythm when it keeps changing all the time because there are so many players that want to get in there.
Yeah, I think one of our great strengths is our depth through the midfield, and I think we've found a really good balance, especially the second half of the year, is finding minutes for everyone. But also, as you touched on, the rhythm of the game, and can be quite hard if you get moved around at heaps of different places. So, I think having a settled lineup has really helped with injuries and stuff as well, finding that rhythm, and full credit to the coaches in helping us put us in a position to perform.
So
Jackson, you move your attention now to a final series. Obviously, last year against the Giants, you guys were accused of not flying the flag and not playing finals football. Does that still sting? Is that still a thought that comes to mind about last year, or is it just, or do you quickly move on and it's a whole new ball game against St Kilda?
Yeah, a bit of both. Obviously, it stings when you think about that game. You never want to go out in a fashion like that. But at the same time, I'm not playing the game thinking about GWS last year. So obviously, we're going to do everything in our power to, you know, perform in a much better way. But at the same time, it's a completely different year and completely different group as well. So, you know, we'll be very focused on St Kilda and what we need to bring to perform.
The captain of the 2020 AFL All-Australian team is Patrick Dangerfield of the Geelong Football Club.
Right on, mate. Thanks, Ed.
Well deserved.
Very, very humbling. Lost for words, to be honest.
That was the announcement last night. Gillen, the chief, talking about the captaincy appointment for the All-Australian team for 2020. And as you heard, it went to Patrick Dangerfield, who is an 8-time All-Australian. And it was vice-captain in 2018. Now, All-Australian captain is one of the 22 selected last night. Boomer Harvey knows all about being a record breaker and a legend of the game. He's the AFL Games record holder amongst a host of accolades that he has on the resume. He joins us on the Friday morning. Good morning, Boomer.
Good morning, boys. Did Patrick Dangerfield just call Gil McLachlan Ledge then? Did I hear that right? Did he say thanks, Ledge?
I don't know. Can we have another listener then?
The captain of the 2020 AFL All-Australian team is Patrick Dangerfield of the Geelong Football Club.
Right on, mate. Thanks, Ledge. Well deserved.
I think he might have said Ledge.
He might have said thanks, Ledge.
No, I think he said thanks, Ed, because Eddie McGuire was there also.
Oh,
I think he said thanks, Ed, first.
Okay, well, so I'm not like sure.
We might need to go to the lab to analyse that bit later on with Kingy.
Yeah.
We'll go to the yard. That works well.
Go to the yard. It would be funny if it was that. But it's a funny part of the year now, isn't it? You get all the awards nights, which everyone disagrees with, obviously. I mean, I've got some names I can throw around for the All-Australian team that missed out. And when you do throw these names out, there's nothing wrong with the guys that made the team, obviously. You're just trying to pick your own team. And then you've got all the delistings. It's unbelievable.
There's a bit to talk about in the awards night last night, which we haven't touched on, so we'll do that with you, Boomer. Just going through the team, the All-Australian team for 2020, according to the selectors last night. Before I do that, did anyone ever disagree with one of your four selections, Boomer? Anyone ever say, Boomer Harvey shouldn't have been in it?
I disagree with all of them.
Probably all the Essendon supporters. I'm sure they did half. I was on the bench for a couple of them, mate. So I'm sure they disagreed with most of them.
From the back line, the All-Australian team. Brad Shepherd, Harris Andrews, Luke Ryan from Fremantle. Never previously All-Australian. Neither was Brad Shepherd, so first-timers as well. In fact, the back six is very, very new. Nick Haynes, a first-timer at halfback. Darcy Moore, first-timer, and Darcy Byrne-Jones. Two Darcys on the one line. Unusual for an All-Australian team, a first-timer as well. On the centre line, Jack McRae, Travis Boak, and Cam Guthrie, a first-timer. Half-forward line of Dangerfield, the 8-timer, as I mentioned. Charlie Dixon was a first-timer, and Marcus Bontempelli. The forward pocket, Liam Ryan, first-timer, Tom Hawkins, and Dustin Martin. And in the Iraq on-ball division, Nick Natanui. He's not a first-timer, he's a second-timer. Christian Petrarca is a first-timer, and Lockie Neal as well. The interchange, Jack Steele, Taylor Adams, Caleb Daniel, and Max Gawn. All of those interchanges, except for Max, are first-time All-Australians. So we had two. Now, Max Gawn and Taylor Adams are part of our inner sanctum. We had three.
Marcus Bontempelli. Marcus Bontempelli.
Well, he was sort of half with us this year. So we'll claim the bond as...
Absolutely we will claim it.
...as one of our team members here on the Breakfast Club. So three-timer. Boomer, what did you like and not like about that?
Well, I'm going to throw some names out who I thought were a little bit stiff. Again, these guys who made it, fantastic and congratulations. But the forward line for me, I get confused every single year. Are they picking this team to play against someone?
Well, that's what they keep
telling
us.
Sometimes they say they are, and sometimes they say they're not.
They say they are.
They say they
are. They say they are. Well, they've picked one small forward in Liam Ryan. So Dangerfield's going to go up and try to get 30 in the midfield. Bontempelli's going to go up in the midfield and get 30. Dustin Martin's going to go in the midfield and have 30. So you've got one stay-at-home small forward. I would have thought Papley, Butler, who I think had an outstanding year, and Charlie Cameron. They kicked 26, Butler kicked 27, and Cameron 26. Liam Ryan kicked a few goals, but the rest, Dangerfield and Bontempelli only kicked 11 goals as midfielders. That's not a massive return for someone. They both spend a little bit of time forward. It's not even a... Well, it's just... What is it? Just over a goal a game. Just under a half a goal a game. So it's not a huge one. The backs, I thought Whitfield was really stiff. I think he's the most damaging player in the competition off half back. Jake Lloyd had the most possessions. I know it's not about that and might have had a few goals kicked on him, but gee, he's a good player. Wietering and Grimes both probably deserve to be in. The rucks, I'm going to question. Nat Nui, I'm not convinced about. Love him as a player. I think he's outstanding, but... Oh, I thought my man, Big Todd Goldstein, had a decent year. And then the mids, I don't know how Sam Menegola missed out. And I would have him in. Again, no disrespect to Cam Guthrie, but I would have Menegola on a wing every single day of the week. I think he might have kicked 13 goals, which is a great return for a winger.
Just on that, the wingers are actually a specific position now, the way teams are set up and structured.
Probably so, more so than ever before.
Yeah, yep. Yeah. So Menegola, Andrew Gaff, Hugh McCluggage, those type of players that play as genuine wingmen and really important structurally was a little bit surprising. I'm not saying McRae or Guthrie didn't deserve it, but to be positioned on a wing was, I thought, a little bit interesting. And then, you know, your half forwards, there's genuine half forwards in the competition that play there and play that role, a really selfless role that they have to play now up and down the field. So, but look at it. It's always like this. I think half hit it on the head earlier. It should be selected seven defenders, seven forwards and then eight midfielders. So that's how the team should be selected, rather than positions, because it's simply not positional.
Now, Daniel and I have made a rule from a couple of years ago. We don't get emotional about the All-Australian team. Now, last year I broke my rule because Travis Boak wasn't named. It's good to see him there. But it is an impossible task, Grammer. And I think, you can't leave Marcus Bontempelli out of the team. He's had an outstanding year, and you've got to find a way to put him in. And Dangerfield's a bit the same, but the ones to me, I mean, Jake Lloyd, for the role that he plays, no one plays that role better in the competition. Yeah, that's the case. Dylan Grimes, I mean, you've got to have Dylan Grimes in there, at least one of Dylan Grimes or Nick Vlosten. But the two that stand out for me, is Tom Jonas. I mean, geez, he's a very good player and has had an outstanding year, not just statistically, but also from a leadership perspective. But the one that stands out to me, by so far it's not funny, is how you could not have a 2020 All-Australian team and not have Nat Fyfe in there just beggars belief. His level is so high. Now, yeah. I know he had an injury, but his level is so high that to meet that level every year is almost impossible. But they find a way to put Dangerfield in every year. Nathan Fyfe, have a look at what he's done this year. It's comparable to his Brownlow years.
Yeah, he gets looked at Nate Fyfe level. He doesn't get looked at the level of everybody else. And I totally agree with that. It's happened for years. And would it be a little bit different or better? I'd love to find out what you think here. For the coaches that actually do it. I know in different leagues around Australia, they pick the coaches... One, but mate, you're trying to tell me that if you're picking a team, you're not going to have Lachie Whitfield running off halfback from any coach's point of view. I find that really, really hard to believe. I know they don't pick this team, so it's probably not going to end up like that, but it's strange that... That's a great point, Whitey, about Nate Fyfe. He's judged on Nate Fyfe, not on everybody else.
The actual six defenders they selected, they actually defend, which is probably... a little bit different, really. So if you look at those six defenders, they actually defend.
Okay, so why don't you put a defensive forward, you know, one of those ones that chase and tackle every single week, but don't kick goals or don't have 25 possessions from the midfield.
I'd be comfortable with that.
Probably just want some clarity around if they're going to pick this team to play against other teams, but this is not a realistic team for me.
Well done to all who won the All-Australian football.
But that's the other thing. That's the other thing.
Players last night.
We've all got our opinion on this. Yeah, we've all got our opinion on this, but it's 100% right. Well done to Cam Guthrie, who I think Menegola should be in before. But well done to Cam Guthrie for having an outstanding year. So it's, well done. Well done.
Can you imagine, just put yourself around the table. Well, think of the discussion we're having, and all the discussions that our listeners would be having in their own heads at the moment about who should be in there and who shouldn't be and who and why and how and what. Imagine being around the table. I actually don't know how they get a result, I must admit.
No, yeah. I agree.
I'm not sure whether Ben's got this totally wrong or his management group have got this wrong, but I don't know, and I'm happy for you to answer this question, how you can have a contract that has 3 years on it, somewhere between $2.3 and $2.4 million attached to it for that period, and get to the end of the year and have nothing in front of you, and now looking for another club. So something's gone wrong here. Either he's had a really bad read at what the Kangaroos put in front of him, or he got simply out of alignment with what the rest of the AFL community are earning. But to be in this situation, I think, is a disaster on all fronts, for Ben personally and for the group that's managing him.
But that was David King on AFL 360 on Fox Footy the other night, talking about the number one story in football this week. It was the decision from the Kangaroos to decide that they would like Ben Brown to look for other avenues to continue his AFL career. We actually, Whitey, we know the manager of Ben Brown pretty well. And we've also got a champion of the football club as part of our team on a Friday as well. I wonder what they're thinking this week and this morning. When you heard that, Rammer, what did you think from Kingy?
That's his opinion, of course. But I don't think anybody's out of alignment here. We were very comfortable in saying always that Ben wanted to stay at North Melbourne, and Ben wanted to be a North Melbourne player for the remainder of his career. So when that contract was taken off the table was a very, very long time ago. So there's no misalignment from anybody. So Ben was engaged there. You look at Ben's work that he does with the AFLW team, with the community work he does at North Melbourne. He was a North Melbourne player. So, you know, but clubs make decisions, and we obviously have to look for another home now.
So why wouldn't he, if I'm playing devil's advocate and want to punch up a bit, why wouldn't he sign that three-year deal at the start of the year? If he wanted to be a North Melbourne player and he's 29 or whatever he is.
Because we wanted a fourth year, and we thought we're in our right to be asking for that, considering what he had achieved.
Even though it would have got him to 32 or whatever it was at the time.
31.
Yeah.
So in asking for that, going into this year, Ben Brown had kicked goals in 2019, 64 goals, 61 goals in 2018, 63 goals in 2017. So that was more goals than anyone else in the competition. Yep. I think you're entitled to ask for 4 years. Does it feel, Rammer, like he's been sacked? Or does it feel like you're on different pages now, it's time to see other people, which kind of is being sacked?
I think clearly North Melbourne are moving in a different direction with the way they want to play, and they don't see Ben as a part of that, which I find probably staggering, considering what you just reeled off there and how good of a player he has been for North Melbourne in that key forward role.
So, and I know you're very respectful with your players, and we don't usually talk about your players publicly, but was he being shopped around before this happened, or was he, no, I want to stay at North Melbourne?
His number one preference, and I'll make this very clear, has always been to stay at North Melbourne.
So, Rammer, what he touched on, he had three fantastic years before this year. I'm a firm believer on the forwards are a byproduct of what happens up the field. Now, North Melbourne clearly struggled in lots of areas this year. That's pretty obvious. Ben having a really poor start in terms of just output, in terms of just goals, because that's how full forwards really get judged, let's face it, if they haven't kicked the bags. Yep. Did that hinder the negotiations? Did that sort of make it stop a little bit and then say, well, he's not kicking goals? He has kicked 60, 60 and 60, but he's only kicked 7 to halfway mark of the year or anything like that?
No, I don't think that hindered it. I think Reece had a shift in how he and North Melbourne, how they wanted to play moving forward. Now, whether they think Ben can perform that or not is up to them, and it's their decision. So, you know, Ben had no doubt he didn't have the seven or eight games that he wanted to have this year, but I don't think it's a reflection of him as a footballer at all. And I know that he's got a big future wherever he's playing his football next year.
Will that take a long time to determine, Rama, where he will play? As in, are there a number of clubs that have shown interest, are you very clear on a particular club that they want? No. They want him, and he wants to go there.
No. There's no one particular club that we're targeting. I think it's you survey the landscape of what's going to be available for him, and then we work from there.
Fast forward a couple of years. Fast forward a couple of years, there would probably be a team in Tassie. It would have been a pretty easy decision for him because he loves his homeland.
Boomer, your thoughts on the footy club? Now, there were talk when you and Drew left the footy club that was the time to really slice and dice the list and start again. And you sort of went through a semi-renovation, if you like, or a fairly significant renovation.
Yep.
Are you worried about where the footy club's at the moment, or is this the right decision that they're making to say, you know what, we've got to rebuild, we've got to do it aggressively?
Yeah, it's a little bit unfortunate that Reece has come in at this stage with the list that he's got. And we did have a lot of injuries this year, and people are going to roll their eyes and say, so did everybody else, in a hub, and I get all that stuff as well. But my honest opinion, and I need to make this clear, I'm not bitter for the 1 year I might have missed out on, right? I'm very privileged to play for 21 years. And let's focus on the 21 years I played and not the one that I might have missed out on. But when the football club decided to move myself, Dal, Spud and Drewy on, I thought that was their rebuild. And that was how it was told to us as well. We know we have to rebuild. We just scraped into the finals and we've got an ageing list. So that's fantastic. That's great. All right? Wishes all the best. But then they go out and get a Dom Tyson, a Tom Campbell, an Aaron Hall, a Marley Williams. Now, has that worked for them? Probably not. Fast forward 3 years down the track. This should have happened the year after they got rid of myself and Drew and the other boys. So that should have happened the year after, and they should have clean slated it, gone to the draft and gone your Bailey Scotts and your Taran Thomases, get a few more of them boys. And right now, they would be in a pretty decent position. But unfortunately for Reece, Brady, Glenn Luff, the list manager, and all these type of guys, the recruiting officers, I feel that this should have happened 3 years ago. I feel like we've wasted 3 years now. That's how I feel about the North Melbourne Football Club right now. And I really, really, really feel for Reece and Brady and the team right now, because this was set in place 4 years ago.
Yeah, it's a huge challenge. As you said before, Whitey, Sean Higgins has been told that he can't secure his future after next year, so he's entitled to look around and see if he can get another
couple of years. I'm comfortable with that half.
No, if they're going to go down this path, that's not a silly decision.
The other thing they did the year after they got those boys, then came in Jared Pollock and Jasper Pittard. Now, we've seen how the Pollock thing, we've all read the speculation, whether he's going to move on or not, I've got no idea because I haven't spoken to no one from the football club. And then the Jasper Pittard, he's already been let go. So there's another two that they brought in thinking that they're on the verge of a final series maybe.
But that is the old administration or football department. This is the new one now.
I feel sorry for the boys coming in now because they look like they're getting whacked for a decision that should have got made 3 years ago.
That was the best of the Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.